Clutching Atlas by the shoulders, she yanked him forward, and he followed her into the closet as the overhead light clicked back off. Watt. Watson Bakrati leaned back in the stiff auditorium chair, studying the chessboard currently displayed over his field of vision. Move rook 3 spaces on the left diagonal. The chessboard, projected in ghostly white and black onto the high-res contacts he constantly wore, changed accordingly. That wasn't a wise move, pointed out Nadia, the quantum computer embedded in Watt's brain. Her knight immediately swooped forward to capture his king. Watt stifled a groan, eliciting a few strange looks from the friends and classmates seated around him. He quickly fell silent and focused his gaze forward, to where a man in a crimson blazer stood at a podium, explaining the liberal arts offerings at Stringer West University. Watt tuned him out, just like he'd done all the other speakers at this mandatory assembly for the junior class. As if Watt had any intention of taking a history or English class again after high school was over. You've been losing to me on average 11 minutes more quickly than normal. I believe it's a sign of distraction, Nadia added, flashing the words over his contacts like an incoming flicker. You think? Watt thought testily. Watt had good reason to be distracted lately. He had taken what seemed like an easy hacking job for a high-liar girl named Lita, only to fall for her best friend, Avery. Until he'd learned that Avery was actually in love with Atlas, the very same person Lita had hired him to spy on. Then he'd accidentally delivered that secret straight to Lita, who was vicious and high and out for revenge. An innocent girl had ended up dying because of it. And Watt had just stood there and let it happen, let Lita walk away scot-free, because Lita knew about Nadia. Watt wasn't sure how she'd figured it out, but somehow she'd learned Watt's most dangerous secret. Anytime she wanted, Lita could turn Watt in for possession of an illegal quantum computer. Nadia, of course, would be destroyed forever. As for Watt, he'd go to jail for life. If he was lucky. What? Nadia hissed, sending a zap of electric shock down his system. The Stringer representative was stepping down from the podium, replaced by a woman with shoulder-length chestnut hair and a serious expression. Vivian Marsh, the head of admissions at MIT. Few of you will apply to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Even fewer of you have the grades to get in, she said without preamble. But for those of you who do, you'll find that our program rests upon 3 tenets. Explore, experience, evolve. Watt heard a soft pattering of fingers on tablets. He glanced around. Some of the kids from his advanced math classes were typing furiously, hanging on Vivian's every word. His friend Cynthia, a pretty Japanese-American girl who'd been in Watt's classes since practically kindergarten, was on the edge of her seat, her eyes lit up. Watt hadn't even known Cynthia was interested in MIT. Would he have to compete against her for the limited spots? Watt hadn't really considered what he would do if he didn't get into MIT. For years he had dreamed of attending their extremely competitive microsystems engineering program. It was the research team in that very department that had invented the Millet chip and entanglement software and the room temperature supermagnets that prevented quantum decoherence. Watt had always assumed he would get in. Hell, he'd invented a quantum computer on his own at age 14. How could they not take him? Except that he couldn't exactly talk about Nadia on his application. And as he looked around at the other students, Watt was forced to confront the very real possibility that he might not get in after all. Should I ask a question? He thought anxiously to Nadia. Something, anything to get Vivian to notice him. This isn't a Q&A, Watt, Nadia observed. Suddenly, far too quickly, the Stanford rep was stepping up and clearing his throat. Without thinking, Watt shot to his feet, cursing as he stumbled down the row of seats. "Seriously?" Cynthia mouthed as he climbed over her, but Watt didn't care. He needed to talk to Vivian, and anyway, Stanford was at best his safety school. He burst out the double doors at the back of the auditorium, ignoring the eyes that turned accusatorily toward him as he did, and began sprinting around the corner to the school exit. "Miss Marsh, wait!" She paused, one hand on the door, an eyebrow raised. Well, at the very least he would be memorable. "I have to say, it's rare that I'm chased out of a school auditorium. I'm not a celebrity, you know." Watt thought he heard an edge of wry amusement behind her tone, but couldn't be sure. "I've been dreaming of going to MIT ever since I can remember, and I really wanted to speak with you." "Your name," Nadia prompted. "Watson Bakrati," he said quickly, holding out a hand. After a moment, Vivian shook it. "Watson Bakrati," she repeated. Her gaze turned inward, and Watt realized she was doing some kind of search of him through her contacts. She blinked and focused on him again. "I see that you participated in our Young Engineer Summer Program on scholarship. And you weren't invited back." Watt flinched. He knew exactly why he hadn't been asked to return, because one of his professors had caught him building an illegal quantum computer. She had promised not to alert the police, but still, the mistake had cost him. Nadia had pulled Vivian's CV onto his contacts, but it wasn't helpful. All it told Watt was that she'd grown up in Ohio and had studied psychology as an undergraduate. He realized that he needed to answer her. "That program was 4 years ago. I've learned a lot since then, and I'd like the chance to prove it to you." Vivian tilted her head, accepting a ping. "I'm speaking with a student," she said to whoever it was, probably an assistant. I know. Just one moment." As she tucked a strand of hair behind one ear, Watt caught a glimpse of an expensive platinum wrist computer. He wondered, suddenly, what she really thought of coming down to speak on the 240th floor, even if it was at a magnet school. No wonder she was in a hurry to leave. "Mr. Bakrati, why is MIT your top choice?" Nadia had pulled up the MIT guidelines and mission statement, but Watt didn't want to give a safe, canned answer. "Microsystems engineering. I want to work with quants," he said boldly. "Really?" She looked him up and down, and Watt could tell her interest was piqued. "You know that program receives thousands of applications, but only selects 2 students per year." "I know. It's still my top choice." "It's my only choice," Watt thought, giving his best smile, the one he always used on girls when he and Derek went out. He felt her softening toward him. "Have you ever seen a quant? Do you know how unbelievably powerful they are?" "An untruth would be optimal here," Nadia told him, but Watt knew he could dance around the question. "I know there are only a few left," he said instead. There were quants at NASA, of course, and the Pentagon, though Watt had a feeling there were far more illegal and unregistered quants, like Nadia, than the government would care to admit. "However, I think there should be more. There are so many places we need quantum computers." "Like in your brain? Watt, be sensible," Nadia urged, but he wasn't listening. "We need them now more than ever. We could revolutionize global farming to eradicate poverty. We could eliminate fatal accidents. We could terraform Mars." Watt's voice rang overly loud in his ears. He realized that Vivian was looking at him, her eyebrows raised, and he fell silent. You sound eerily like the science fiction writers of the last century. I'm afraid that your opinion is no longer popular these days, Mr. Bacrati, she said at last. Watt swallowed. I just think the AI incident of 2093 could have been avoided. The quant in question wasn't responsible. The security hadn't been properly set. There was an issue with his core programming. Back when quants were still legal, they'd all been given the same piece of fundamental core programming, that the quant could take no action to harm a human being, no matter what later commands were given to it. His? Vivian repeated, and Watt realized belatedly that he'd used a gendered pronoun to describe a computer. He said nothing. After a moment, she sighed. Well, I have to say, I look forward to personally reviewing your application. She stepped through the door and into a waiting hover. Nadia, what on earth do we do now? He thought, hoping she might have a brilliant solution. She usually picked up on situational details that he had missed. There's only one thing you can do, Nadia replied. And that is to write the best damn essay Vivian Marsh has ever seen. There you are, Cynthia breathed when Watt finally made his way to their locker. Technically, it was Cynthia's locker. Watt had been assigned one, but it was at the end of the arts hallway, and since he never went that direction and never carried much stuff anyway, he'd gotten in the habit of using Cynthia's instead. Derek, Watt's best friend, stood there too, worry creasing his forehead. Yeah, what happened? Cynthia says you skipped out early? I went to try to talk to the MIT admissions officer before she left. What did you tell her? Cynthia asked, while Derek shook his head, muttering something that sounded like, should have thought of that. Watt sighed. I'm not sure it went well. Cynthia glanced at Watt in sympathy. I'm sorry. Hey, at least if I tank, it'll increase your chances of getting in, Watt replied, a little too flippant. But sarcasm had always been his defense mechanism. Cynthia seemed hurt. I would never think like that. Honestly, I was hoping that we would both end up at MIT. It could be nice, having a friendly face so far from home. And then I'll come visit you both and pester you constantly, Derek said, throwing his arms jovially around both their shoulders. That would be fun, Watt said cautiously, with a glance at Cynthia. He hadn't realized that they shared the same dream. She was right. It would be nice, walking across the leaf-strewn campus together on their way to class, working together in the engineering lab late at night, getting lunch in that enormous arched dining hall Watt had seen on the iNet. Then again, what would he and Cynthia do if only one of them got in? It'll be fine, he told himself, but he couldn't help thinking that this was just one more thing in his life that could end in disaster. He seemed to be collecting a lot of those lately. Rylan. That same afternoon, Rylan Myers leaned forward on the checkout scanner, counting down the minutes till her shift at Arrow Kid was over. She knew she was lucky to have this job. It paid more than her old one at the monorail, and the hours were better. But every moment here still felt like utter torture. Arrow Kid was a mass retailer of children's clothing in the mid-Manhattan Mall, up on the 500th floor. Until recently, Rylan had never set foot in a store like this. Arrow was the kind of place where mid-tower parents came in packs, wearing brightly colored exercise pants and dragging toddlers by the arm, strollers bobbing through the air alongside them, pulled by invisible magnetic tethers. Rylan glanced around the store, which was a dizzying kaleidoscope of sound and color. Jarring pop music played on high volume through the speakers. The entire space smelled overwhelmingly of Arrow Kids' sickly, sweet, self-cleaning cloth diapers. And crammed on every display were children's clothes, from pastel-colored baby onesies to dresses in a girl size 14, all of it covered in arrows. Arrow-stitched baby jeans, arrow-printed t-shirts, even little blankets covered in tiny flashing arrows. It made Ryland's eyes hurt just to look at it. "Hey, Rye, can you help out the customer in fitting room 12? I'll man checkout for a while." Ryland's manager, a 20-something named Aaliyah, sauntered over and flipped her close-cut dark hair. There was a bright purple arrow on her shirt, spinning slowly like the hands of a clock. Ryland had to look away to keep from feeling dizzy. "Of course," Ryland said, trying not to be irritated that Aaliyah had started calling her by the nickname she reserved for close friends. She knew her manager just wanted to duck under the counter and ping her new girlfriend when she thought the employees couldn't see. She knocked on the door of fitting room 12.
"Just wanted to see how things were going in there," she said loudly. "Any sizes I can grab for you?"
The door swung open to reveal a tired-looking mom perched on a stool, her eyes glazed over as she probably checked something on her contacts. A pink-cheeked girl with a smattering of freckles stood before the mirror, turning back and forth as she studied her reflection with critical intensity. She was wearing a white dress that read, "Be Dazzling," and was covered in tiny crystal arrows. Her feet were encased in a pair of arrow-printed boots. They already belonged to the girl. If she'd picked them up today, Ryland would have seen a subtle holographic circle marking them as a new purchase, reminding her to ring them up. She thought of the times she and her best friend, Lux, used to shoplift on the lower floors. Nothing big, just a couple of tubes of perfume and paint stick, or once a box of chocolate puffs. Couldn't get away with that up here.
"What do you think of this?"
the girl asked, turning to let Ryland inspect her. Ryland gave a watery smile. Her eyes darted to the mom. After all, she was the one who would pay. But the older woman seemed content to stay out of her daughter's shopping habits.
"It looks great,"
Ryland said weakly.
"Would you wear it?"
the little girl asked, her nose wrinkling adorably. For some reason, all Ryland could think of were the clothes she and Krissa used to wear, some of which had been given by the Andertons, the upper-floor family she'd worked for as a maid. Ryland's favorite outfit at age 6 had been a swashbuckling pirate costume, complete with a feathered cap and a gold-hilted sword. She realized with a start that it had probably once belonged to Cord, or Bryce. The knowledge should have made her embarrassed, yet all she felt was a strange sense of loss. She hadn't spoken to Cord in a month. Probably wouldn't even see him ever again. "It's for the best," she told herself, the way she always did when she thought of Cord. But it never seemed to work.
"Clearly not,"
the girl huffed, pulling the dress back up over her head.
"You can go,"
she added pointedly to Ryland. Ryland realized belatedly that she'd made an error. She tried desperately to backtrack.
"I'm sorry, I just lost track of my thoughts for a moment."
"Forget it,"
the girl said in a single breath, slamming the door in Ryland's face. Moments later, she and her mom were walking out of the store, leaving a pile of discarded clothes in the fitting room behind them.
"Rye!"
Aaliyah made a disappointed clucking noise as she walked over.
"That girl was an easy sale. What happened?"
"Don't rhyme me," Ryland thought with a sudden burst of anger. But she knew better than to say anything. The whole reason she had this job was because of Aaliyah. She'd been applying for a waitress job at the cafe next door when she'd seen the shooting arrow display that spelled out "Help Wanted" in the holographic window, and stepped inside on a whim. Aaliyah hadn't even cared that she had no experience in retail. She had taken one look at Ryland and let out an excited squeal.
You can totally fit into our junior sizes. Your hips are, like, really narrow. And your feet are even small enough for some of the sandals.
So here Rylan was, wearing the least offensive merchandise she could find in the store. A tank top and her own black jeans, not an arrow in sight. Trying half-heartedly to sell clothes to Midtower kids. No wonder she sucked at it.
I'm sorry. I'll do better next time, she promised.
I hope so. You've been here almost a month, and yet you've barely hit the sales minimum for a single week. I keep making excuses for you, saying it's a learning curve, but if things don't change soon...
Rylan bit back a sigh. She couldn't afford to be fired, not again.
Got it.
Aaliyah's eyes flicked as she glanced at the time in the corner of her vision. Rylan had been surprised that most girls who worked here could afford to wear contacts, even if it was just the cheaper versions. Then again, this was an after-school job for most of them. They didn't have younger sisters to support, or a never-ending stack of bills to pay.
Why don't you head home, get some rest?
Aaliyah suggested gently. I'll close up. That way you can start fresh tomorrow, okay?
Rylan was too exhausted to argue. That would be amazing, she said simply.
And Rye, why don't you take one of those?
Aaliyah gestured toward a display near the entrance of printed t-shirts in a bright lemon yellow covered in purple arrows.
To wear to work tomorrow? It might help you feel a little more enthusiastic.
Those are for 10-year-olds, Rylan couldn't help pointing out, eyeing the shirts with trepidation.
Good thing you're super skinny, Aaliyah replied.
Rylan held her breath as she grabbed the shirt at the top of the stack.
Thanks, she said, flashing the biggest smile she could manage. But the older girl was already on a ping, her hand to her ear as she whispered something and laughed.
When Rylan waved her ID ring over the touchpad in the door and stepped inside, the comforting smells of batter and warm chocolate rose up to meet her. She felt an immediate stab of regret that Krissa had beat her home yet again. Ever since Rylan had started working evenings, rather than the crack of dawn shift she'd had at the monorail, Krissa had been handling more of the cooking and grocery shopping. Rylan felt guilty. Those had always been her jobs. She wanted to be the one taking care of her 14-year-old sister, not the other way around.
How was work?
Krissa asked cheerfully. Her eyes drifted to Rylan's new t-shirt and she pursed her lips, suppressing a smile.
Don't you dare say anything, or your birthday present this year will be nothing but a huge bag of arrow-printed underwear.
Krissa tilted her head as if considering it.
How many arrows per pair are we talking exactly?
Rylan let out a laugh, then fell silent.
Honestly, at this rate, I'll be fired long before your birthday. Turns out I'm not the best salesperson.
She came to where Krissa stood at the cooktop, making the banana pancakes they both loved so much.
Breakfast for dinner? What's the occasion?
She asked, and reached into the bag of chocolate flakes to grab a handful. Krissa batted good-naturedly at Rylan's hand, then tossed the rest of the chocolate flakes into the mix and let the infra-powered spoon stir the batter. She looked up at her sister with evident excitement, jerking her chin toward an envelope on the table.
You got some news.
What is that? No one sent real paper envelopes anymore. The last one Rylan had gotten was a medical bill, and even that was in addition to her weekly reminder pop-ups with sound, and only because the payment was a year past due.
Why don't you open it and see?
Krissa said mysteriously. Rylan's first thought was that the envelope was heavy, which signified something momentous, though she wasn't sure whether to be excited or afraid. There was a familiar blue crest embossed on the back. The Berkeley School, since 2031, it read in gilded letters across the top. That was Cord's school, Rylan remembered, up in the 900s somewhere. Why would they be sending anything to her? She slid a fingernail beneath the crisp edge of the envelope and pulled out its contents, dimly aware that Krissa had come to stand next to her, but she was too focused on reading the strange and surprising letter to say anything. Dear Miss Myers, we are pleased to inform you that you have been selected as the inaugural recipient of the Heiress Miranda Dodd Radson Memorial Award to Berkeley Academy. The scholarship was established in memory of Heiress to reward unrecognized individual potential in underprivileged students. The value of your scholarship is detailed on the next page. Full tuition is covered, as well as a stipend for academic materials and other cost-of-living expenses. Rylan blinked up at Krissa. What on earth is this? She asked slowly. Krissa squealed and threw her arms around Rylan in a breathless hug.
I was hoping this was a yes envelope, but I wasn't sure, and I didn't want to open it without you. Rylan!
She took a step back and looked at her sister, her entire being suffused with a happy glow.
You got a scholarship to Berkeley! That's the best private high school in New York, maybe even in the country!
But I didn't apply, Rylan pointed out, to which Krissa laughed.
I applied on your behalf, of course. You aren't mad, are you?
She added, as if the thought had just now occurred to her.
But...
A million questions rippled through Rylan's mind. She seized on one randomly.
How did you even find out about this scholarship?
Rylan had known about it, of course. She'd seen it mentioned on Eris's obituary video, which she'd watched dozens of times since that fateful night. The night her whole life turned upside down. When she went to an up-tower party, way, way up on the 1,000th floor, only to find the boy she loved with another girl. Then that girl had died in front of Rylan's eyes, pushed off the side of the tower by one of her drugged-out friends, who proceeded to blackmail Rylan, forcing her to keep quiet about what had really happened. I saw the obit video pulled up on your tablet. You watched it a lot of times, Krissa said, and now her voice was quiet, and her eyes were searching Rylan's. You met Heiress when you were with Cord, right? Was she a friend of yours? Something like that, Rylan said, because she didn't know how to tell Krissa the truth, that Heiress was someone she'd scarcely known, except that Rylan had seen her die. I'm sorry about what happened to her. The timer beeped, and Krissa scooped the pancakes into two fat stacks, handing the plates to Rylan. But Rylan still didn't understand. Why didn't you apply to the scholarship for yourself? Of the two of them, Krissa was the one with real promise. She made straight A's in her honors classes and would probably play volleyball at the college level. She was the one who deserved a fancy upper school scholarship. Not Rylan, who hadn't even been in school the last few years. Because I don't need it like you do, Krissa said intently. Rylan followed her to the table, carrying the plates of stacked pancakes. One of the legs of their table was broken clean off, causing it to wobble as she set the plates down. Between my grades and volleyball, I'm on track to get a college scholarship anyway. You, on the other hand, need this, Krissa insisted. Don't you see? Now you don't have to be the girl who dropped out of school to work a dead-end job for my sake. Rylan fell silent at the flicker of guilt in her sister's explanation. She'd never really considered what Krissa had thought when Rylan had dropped out of school to work full-time after their mom died. She'd never imagined that Krissa might blame herself for Rylan's choice. Krissa, you know it's not your fault that I took the job I did, and Rylan knew that she would do it all again in a heartbeat, to give her little sister the chance she deserved. Then she thought of another complication.
Anyway, I can't quit work now. We need the money.
Chris's smile was contagious.
Didn't you see what it said about a cost of living stipend? It's enough to keep us going, and if we get into a tight spot, we can always figure something out.
Rylan looked again and saw that Krissa was right.
But why would they pick me? I'm not even in school right now. There must have been so many applicants.
Her eyes narrowed at Krissa as she began to think through the odds.
What did you put on my application anyway?
Krissa grinned.
I found an old essay of yours about working at a summer camp and made some tweaks to it.
2 years before their mother died, Rylan had applied to be a junior counselor at an expensive summer camp. It was all the way in Maine, somewhere with a lake, or maybe it had been a river. The kind of place rich kids went to learn useless things like canoeing and archery and braiding friendship bracelets. For some reason, maybe because she'd seen too many hollows about summer camp, Rylan had always fostered a secret desire to attend one. Of course, they could never afford anything like that. But Rylan had hoped that maybe if she worked there as a counselor, she would still have a version of the experience. She'd gotten the job, though it quickly became irrelevant because her mom had gotten sick that year and nothing else mattered after that.
I can't believe you found that, she said, shaking her head in amused wonder.
She would never cease to be surprised by Chris's resourcefulness.
Though I still don't understand why they would pick me.
Krissa shrugged.
Didn't you see the description? It's a weird, non-traditional scholarship for creative-minded girls who would otherwise be overlooked.
I'm not exactly creative-minded, Rylan argued. Krissa shook her head so violently that her ponytail whipped back and forth, a dark shadow behind her head.
Of course you are! Stop selling yourself short, or you'll never survive at that school.
Rylan didn't answer that. She still wasn't sure whether or not she was going. After a moment, Krissa sighed.
I'm not surprised you were friends with Eris. From the sound of this scholarship, she was really cool. I mean, she clearly wasn't like the other highliers, if this is how her family chose to honor her.
Suddenly, Rylan's mind was alit with memories of that night. Of breaking up with Cord, then trying to win him back, only to find him with Eris. Of seeing Eris on the roof, yelling at the other girl, Lita, then watching in horror as Eris tumbled off the side of the tower and into the cold night air. She shivered.
You're going, right?
Krissa asked, her voice hopeful.
Rylan thought of how it would feel being at an expensive highlighter school with a bunch of strangers who wouldn't give her the time of day.
Not to mention Cord. She'd promised herself she would stay away from him. And then there was school itself. How would she handle being in a classroom again, learning and studying and taking tests, surrounded by a bunch of students who were probably a lot smarter than she was?
Mom would want you to go, you know, Krissa added. And just like that, Rylan's answer was clear.
She lifted her eyes to her sister's and smiled.
Yeah, I'll go.
Maybe something good could finally come of that night. She owed it to herself and to Krissa and her mom, hell, even to Eris, to try.
Calliope. The two women strode through the entrance to Bergdorf Goodman on the 880th floor, their four sharp heels making satisfying clicks on the polished marble. Neither of them paused at the sumptuously decorated lobby, its holiday-themed display hollows dancing around the crystal chandeliers and jewel cases, tourists crying out whenever the reindeer swooped down toward their heads.
Calliope didn't even glance in their direction as she followed Elise up the curved staircase. It had been a long time since she was impressed by something as prosaic as a holographic sleigh. The designer floor upstairs was scattered with clumps of furniture, each of them partitioned by an invisible privacy barrier and equipped with a body scanner. Real gowns were draped on mannequins in various corners, for nostalgia's sake. No one actually tried on anything here. Elise flicked her eyes significantly at Calliope before heading toward the youngest, most junior-looking employee, Kyra Welch. They'd already pre-selected her online, for the simple reason that she'd worked at the store a grand total of 3 days. Just a few meters away from the girl, Elise made a show of sinking onto a pale peach settee. She crossed one leg over the other and began scrolling through cocktail dresses on the screen before her. Calliope stood idly to one side and stifled a yawn. She wished she'd gotten one of those honey coffees from the hotel this morning, or even a caffeine patch. The sales girl predictably hurried over. She had alabaster skin and a perky carrot-red ponytail.
"Good afternoon, ladies. Did you have an appointment?"
"Where's Alamar?"
Elise demanded in her most dismissive tone.
"I'm so sorry. Alamar is off today,"
Kyra stammered, which of course Elise and Calliope had already known. The girl's eyes skimmed quickly over Elise's outfit, taking in the designer skirt and 7-carat stone on her finger, so high quality it was almost indistinguishable from a real diamond. Evidently, she concluded that this was someone important, someone Alamar shouldn't have upset.
"Perhaps one of our senior sales associates can..."
"I'm looking for a new cocktail dress. Something show-stopping."
Elise talked over the younger woman, waving at the holographic display to project this season's designs onto a scan of her body. She flicked her wrist to scroll rapidly through the images, then held out her palm to pause at a plum-colored dress with an uneven hem.
"Can I see this one, but shortened?"
Kyra's eyes unfocused, probably checking her schedule on her contacts. Calliope knew she was debating whether to abandon her restocking duties in favor of this new, most likely lucrative commission. She also knew that at the end of the shopping spree, after the various dresses had been instantly woven and sewn by the superlooms hidden in the back of the store, Kyra would haltingly ask for an account number to charge it all to.
"Alamar knows," Elise would say, with her, "Sorry, but I can't be bothered," shrug.
Then she would walk out of the store, her arms laden with bags, without a backward glance. Technically, they could have paid for the dresses the normal way. They did have money squirreled away in a few different banks all over the globe. Though at the rate they spent, it never seemed to last very long. And as Elise always said, why pay for something you can get for free? It was the motto they lived by. Elise and Kyra dissolved into a discussion of silk paneling. Calliope looked up, already bored, and saw 3 girls her age crossing the store, wearing identical plaid skirts and white button-downs. A slow smile spread across her face. No matter what country they were in, private school girls invariably made easy targets.
"Mom,"
she interrupted. Kyra stepped aside for a moment to give them some privacy, but it didn't matter. Calliope and her mom had long ago established a code for situations like this.
"I just remembered an assignment that I need to go finish, for history class."
History meant a group con. If she'd used biology class, it would have meant a romantic one, a seduction. Elise's eyes lit on the trio of girls and flashed an instant understanding.
"Of course! I wouldn't want you to lose your place on the honor roll," she said wryly.
"Right. I do need to graduate with honors."
Calliope kept a straight face as she turned away. She muttered, "Nearby private high schools," under her breath as she moved toward the accessory section, where the girl seemed to be headed. It only took 2 search results before she found the right one. She could tell since the students on the homepage were wearing the same lame uniform. Bingo. She stationed herself in the girl's path and began to studiously loiter, picking up various items,
studying them as if actually considering them, then setting them down again. She was keeping an eye on the progress of the group, but still, she couldn't help relishing the feel of a cool leather belt or a slippery silk scarf in her hands. When the girls were only a row away, Calliope stumbled forward, knocking a whole table of purses to the ground. They fell across the polished wood floor like pieces of spilled candy.
"Oh my God, I'm so sorry,"
Calliope muttered in the posh British accent she and her mom had been using all week. Not the cheap Cockney one she'd grown up with, but a refined one she'd mastered after careful practice. She had purposefully tipped the table so that the clutches fell in the girl's direct path, forcing the trio to either step carefully through them or kneel down to help. Unsurprisingly, they did the latter. Rich girls never left something expensive on the ground, unless they'd been the one to toss it there.
"It's okay. No harm done," said one of the girls, a tall blonde who was far and away the most beautiful of the three.
She had such an air of sophistication that on her, the ridiculous school uniform was transformed into something almost chic. She stood up at the same time as Calliope, setting the last little beaded clutch on the table.
"You all go to Berkeley?"
Calliope asked in that crucial instant before they started to walk away.
"Yeah. Wait, do you go there too?"
asked one of the other girls. She frowned a little, as if wondering whether she'd seen Calliope before.
"Oh, no," Calliope said breezily. "I recognize the uniforms from the admissions tour. We're in town from London, staying at the Nuage. But we might move here for my mom's job. If we do, I'll be transferring schools."
The lines rolled easily off her tongue. She'd spoken them many times before.
"That's exciting. What does your mom do?"
The blonde spoke again, not pushy, but with a quiet, genuine interest. Her clear-eyed gaze was somehow disconcerting.
"She works in sales for private clients,"
Calliope couldn't resist saying with a deliberate vagueness.
"So what do you think of Berkeley? You like it there?"
"I mean, it's school. It's not like it's fun," the third girl finally chimed in. She had tawny skin, and her dark hair was pulled into a chic fishtail braid. She quickly looked over Calliope's outfit, taking in her cream-colored knit dress and brown boots, and her eyes grew warmer in evident approval.
"You would like it there, I think," she concluded.
Calliope hid a familiar flash of disdain at these empty-headed girls. They were so easily persuaded of anything, as long as it fit within their narrow worldview. She couldn't wait to con something from them, shave off a little of the wealth they hadn't worked for and were clearly not entitled to at all.
"Nice to meet you. I'm Calliope Brown," she declared, holding out a hand laden with stacked enamel bangles and a fresh dove gray manicolor.
After a moment, the girl took it.
"My name is Risha, and this is Jess and Avery," she told Calliope.
"We actually need to get going," the blonde girl, Avery, said, with an apologetic smile. "We have appointments at the facial bar downstairs."
"No way,"
Calliope lied with a practiced laugh.
"I have an appointment there in half an hour. Maybe I'll see you on your way out."
"You should just come now with us. I bet they can take you early," Risha urged.
She glanced quickly at Avery for confirmation, and Calliope didn't miss the slight nod of approval that Avery gave at the suggestion. So, Avery was the one who called all the shots. Calliope was hardly surprised. She'd never been quite as good at faking friendship as she was a romantic attachment. Lust was so delightfully uncomplicated and straightforward, while female friendships were inevitably layered with conditions and history and unspoken rules of behavior. Still, Calliope was nothing if not a fast learner. She could already see that Risha would be the easiest of the three to win over,
but Avery was the crucial one, so she focused her efforts on her.
"I'd love to come, if you don't mind," she admitted, smiling at each of them in turn, her eyes lingering the longest on Avery.
As they walked through the doors of Ava Beauty Lounge, Calliope took a deep breath, inhaling the glorious scents of lavender and peppermint and spa. Everything inside was done in shades of peach and cream, from the soft carpet underfoot to the delicate sconces hanging on the walls, casting pools of golden light on the girls' faces.
"Miss Fuller," said the store manager, snapping to instant attention.
Calliope studied the other girl with markedly more interest. So, she was the type of person who got recognized at places like this. Was it for her beauty, or her money, or both?
"I didn't realize you were a party of four today. I'll add another facialette station to your cluster."
He began to usher them all forward just as another girl walked out of the inner lounge and froze at the sight of Avery.
"Hi, Lita."
Avery's voice was distinctly chilly. The new arrival, a thin black girl with wide eyes and darting, nervous gestures, pulled herself up to her full height. It wasn't very tall.
"Avery, Jess, Risha."
Her eyes lit on Calliope, but she apparently decided it wasn't worth introducing herself.
"Enjoy your facial,"
she said on her way out, managing to turn the innocuous phrase into something almost vindictive.
"Thanks, we will,"
Calliope said cheerfully, delighting at the three horrified expressions that whirled toward her. But she didn't give a damn about these girls' intra-clique drama. She was here for a free facial, thank you very much. Soon the four of them were seated at the gleaming white facial bar, clutching glasses of chilled grapefruit water. A bot wheeled over and handed them each a pink and white stitched apron.
"To keep the facial products from splattering onto your clothes," the facial attendant explained, in answer to Calliope's curious look.
"Oh, right. We wouldn't want the girls to ruin their fabulous uniforms,"
Calliope deadpanned, and was gratified to hear Avery laugh. A row of lasers on the opposite wall turned on, aiming beams of focused photons toward the girls' faces. Calliope instinctively shut her eyes, though she knew the lasers were too precise to hurt her. She felt nothing but a slight tickle across her nerves as the laser skimmed over the surface of her skin, collecting data on her oil levels and pH balance and chemical composition.
"So," she asked Avery, who was sitting to her left, "what's the deal with that Lita girl?"
Avery seemed startled by the question.
"She's a friend of ours," she said quickly.
"She didn't seem that friendly."
The lasers began to flash more quickly, signaling that they were almost finished with their dermatological analysis.
"Well, she was a close friend of mine until recently," Avery amended.
"What happened? Was it about a boy?"
"It usually was with girls like this."
Avery stiffened, though her face remained immobile as the laser traced across her poreless, porcelain skin. Calliope wondered what they would even give her. She was so obviously already perfect.
"It's a long story," Avery answered, which was proof enough to Calliope that she was right.
She felt a momentary stab of sympathy for Lita. That must suck, being the girl who had to compete with Avery. A holographic menu popped up at Calliope's eye level, with treatment recommendations. Next to her, she heard the other girls chatting in low voices as they debated which add-ons to select. A soothing cucumber mask, a hydrogen infusion, a crushed ruby scrub. Calliope checked the boxes for everything. A steaming cocoon dropped down from the ceiling before each of them, and the girls leaned forward and closed their eyes.
"Avery," said the brunette girl.
"Jess," Calliope remembered.
"Your parents' holiday party is still happening this year, right?" Calliope's ears perked up a little at the mention of a party. She turned her head just slightly to the left, letting more of the steam hit the right side of her face, so that she could listen.
"Didn't you get the invitation?" Avery asked.
Jess seemed to quickly back down.
"Yes, but I just thought, after everything that happened..."
"Never mind." Avery sighed, but she didn't sound angry, only regretful.
"There's no way my dad would cancel. During the party, he's going to announce the completion of the mirrors. That's what he named the Dubai Tower, since it has two sides that are mirror images."
"Dubai Tower?"
Suddenly, Calliope remembered what the sales associate had called Avery when they walked in, and the puzzle pieces clicked into place. Fuller Investments was the company that had patented all the structural innovations needed to build towers this tall. The ultra-compounded steel supports, the earthquake shock protectors stuffed between every floor, the oxygenated air that was pumped throughout the higher floors to prevent altitude sickness. They had built the New York Tower, the first global super tower, almost 20 years ago. Which meant that Avery Fuller was very wealthy indeed.
"That sounds like fun," Calliope chimed in.
In her lap, she clenched one hand atop the other, then flipped them over again. She'd been to parties far more exclusive and incredible than this, she tried to remind herself. Like the one at that club in Mumbai with the champagne bottle as big as a small car, or the mountainside lodge in Tibet where they'd grown hallucinogenic tea. But all those parties faded in her memory, as they always did, when confronted by the specter of some other future party that Calliope wasn't invited to. A puff of steam rose from the top of Avery's cocoon as she gave the answer Calliope had been hoping for.
"If you're not busy, you should come."
"I'd love to,"
Calliope said, unable to keep the excitement from her voice. She heard Avery mutter under her breath, and an instant later the envelope icon in the top of her vision lit up as her contacts received the message. Calliope bit her lip to keep from smiling as she opened it. "Fuller Investments Annual Holiday Party," read the scrolling gold calligraphy against a black starry background. 12-12-18. The 1000th floor. It was kind of badass, Calliope admitted to herself, that the only address they needed to write was their floor. Clearly they owned the whole thing. The girl's chatter moved on to something about a school assignment, then a boy that Jess was dating. Calliope let her eyes flutter shut. She did love rich things, she thought with unadulterated pleasure, now that she got them for real, and usually on someone else's dime. It hadn't always been like this. When she was younger, Calliope had known about these sorts of things, but never actually experienced them. She could look, but never touch. It was a particularly excruciating sort of torture. It felt like a long time ago now. She'd grown up in a tiny flat in one of the older, quieter neighborhoods of London, where none of the buildings stretched higher than 30 floors and people still grew real plants out on their balconies. Calliope never asked who her father was, because she honestly didn't care. It had always been Calliope and her mom, and she was fine with that. Elise, she'd had a different name back then, her real name, had been the personal assistant to Mrs. Houghton, a stuffy rich woman with a pinched nose and watery eyes. She insisted on being called Lady Houghton, claiming that she descended from an obscure branch of the now defunct royal family. Elise managed Mrs. Houghton's calendar, her correspondence, her closet, all the myriad details of her useless, gilded life. Elise and Calliope's life felt so dull in contrast. Not that they could complain. Their apartment should have been adequate, with its self-filling refrigerator and cleaning bots and a subscription to all the major holo channels. They even had windows in both bedrooms and a decent closet. Yet Calliope quickly learned to see their life as something unforgivably drab,
illuminated only by the occasional touches of glamour that her mom brought home from the Houghtons.
"Look what I have,"
Elise would proclaim, her voice taut with excitement each time she walked in the door with something new. Calliope always hurried over, holding her breath as her mom unwrapped the package, wondering what it contained this time. An embroidered silk ball gown with sequins missing, which Mrs. Houghton had asked Elise to take back for repairs, or a hand-painted china plate that was one of a kind, and could Elise please track down the artist and have her make another? Even jewelry on occasion. A sapphire ring or a diamond choker that needed to be professionally cleaned. Reverently, Calliope would reach out to touch the sumptuous fur shrug, or crystal wine decanter, or her absolute favorite, the supple Senrev shoulder bag in a shocking bright pink. She would look up into Mother's eyes and see her own childlike longing reflected there, like a candle. Always too soon for Calliope's taste, her mom would pack away the treasure with a sigh of regret to take it to the repair shop or cleaners or back to the store for return. Calliope knew without being told that Elise wasn't even supposed to bring these things home at all, that she did so for Calliope's sake, so that Calliope could get a little glimpse at just how beautiful they were. At least Calliope got the hand-me-downs. The Houghtons had a daughter named Justine, 1 year older than Calliope. For years, Elise had brought Justine's discarded clothing home to their flat, rather than taking it to the donation center as Mrs. Houghton instructed. Together, Calliope and her mom would sort through the bags, exclaiming over the gossamer dresses and patterned stockings and coats with embroidered bows tossed aside like used tissue because they were a season old. When her mom worked late, Calliope would go to her friend Dara's apartment down the hall. They spent hours pretending they were princesses at afternoon high tea. They would put on Justine's old dresses and sip cups of water at Dara's kitchen table, curling up their pinkies in that funny, fancy way, speaking in a butchered approximation of the upper crust accent. "It's my fault you have such a taste for expensive things," Elise said once, but Calliope didn't regret any of it. She would rather see a tiny sliver of that beautiful, charmed world than not know of its existence at all. Everything came to a head one afternoon when Calliope was 11. She'd had the day off from school, so Elise was forced to bring her to Mrs. Houghton's house while she worked. Calliope had firm instructions to stay in the kitchen and read quietly on her tablet, which she did, for almost a full hour, until she heard the little beep of the house comp that meant Lady Houghton had left. Calliope couldn't help it. She darted straight up the stairs into the Houghton's bedroom. The door to Mrs. Houghton's closet was wide open. It was just begging to be explored. Before Calliope could think twice, she'd slipped inside, running her hands longingly over the gowns and sweaters and soft leather pants. She reached for that bright fuchsia Senrev purse and slung it over one shoulder, turning from side to side as she studied her reflection in the mirror, so excited that she didn't hear the second beep of the house comp. If only Dara were here to see this.
"You will address me as your highness and bow when I approach," she said aloud to her reflection, fighting not to giggle. "What do you think you're doing?" came a voice from the doorway.
It was Justine Houghton. Calliope started to explain, but Justine had already opened her mouth to let out a shrill, blood-curdling scream.
"Mom!"
Mrs. Houghton materialized an instant later, accompanied by Elise. Calliope winced under her mom's gaze, hating the way her expression flitted between recrimination and something else, something frighteningly close to guilt.
"I'm sorry,"
she stammered, though her fingers were still closed tight around the handle of the purse, as if she couldn't bear to release it.
"I didn't mean any harm. It's just that your clothes are so beautiful, and I wanted to see them up close."
"So you could get your grubby little hands all over them?"
Mrs. Houghton reached for the Senrev bag, but for some perverse reason, Calliope held it even tighter to her chest.
"And, Mom, look! She's wearing my dress!